From WNYC, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're coming to you from the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. That was excellent. Thank you all so much for coming out. We like to say this show isn't for foodies, it's for eaters. And Mimi Sheridan is a world-class eater. As she told me the last time she was on the show, she hasn't been hungry in 60 years. And whether she's eating a frozen Snickers bar or Russian caviar, you can bet she'll have an opinion on it. She was the first woman to serve as New York Times restaurant critic. She's the author of numerous books. Her most recent is 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Please welcome the one and only Mimi Sheridan.
Brooklyn 70 years ago. And I've never looked back, but I'm glad I'm here tonight.
Well, Mimi, it's great to have you here.
Lovely to be here.
You were the first female restaurant critic of the New York Times, I think 1975. Certainly, you were never a wallflower, Mimi. So you didn't hold back. And I love that recently you've taken to Twitter.
Oh, I love it. I can make so many people mad in 140 characters.
I have a couple of choice bon mots from Mimi's Twitter feed. Eater.com dubs Cassette in Brooklyn a French bistro. Nothing on online menus sounds even remotely French, including owners. Stupid. And then I love PBS silliest food show. Who cares what Phil's having? Gives us no reason to care. Self-styled expert, unconvincing. Remind me not to tell you when my show's on, Mimi.
Trying to perfect the 140 character restaurant review.
But, I mean, have you ever written something negative about someone and later regretted it?
No.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, there must have been confrontations.
There were confrontations. There were lawsuits. There was an insanely angry Italian restaurateur who I had given a negative review who came storming into the New York Times and wanting to see me and the editor, and they sent the Wackenhut guards down to escort him out of the building. In the days when I did it at the Times, the restaurant reviews ran Friday in the weekend section, and there was a lot of restaurant advertising. And when I gave a restaurant of any kind of standing a negative review, they would take a full-page ad to refute it, and the editor said, "We make more money when you give a negative review than when you give a positive review." They never learn, the restaurateurs, that if they get a negative review, the best thing to do is shut up. Because if they make an issue on it, there'll be thousands of people who never read the original review who will suddenly know all about it.
So since you are never at a loss for an opinion, I thought that we would solicit some of your opinions for Sporkful listeners. You know, we often take calls from listeners on our show. And so we have a few callers that I pre-recorded, some messages from, some questions, some debates. And if it's okay, Mimi, let's run through them, and I want to get your take on
these.
Love
it. Go ahead.
Let's start off with Erica. She's getting her master's in public health at Oregon State. Let's see what issues are keeping the next generation of public health leaders up at night.
So I have a problem whenever I drink a latte. I get to the end of my latte, and all of the foam is kind of coating the cup, and I can't figure out if I'm drinking it wrong or if there's some special way that I need to drink it to get all the foam out, because otherwise I'm left there kind of trying to dig out the foam with a spoon.
Is it a latte you make yourself or one you buy at a Starbucks-like location?
I think she's talking about bought latte, like in a paper cup.
Well, I think partly the cup, but it might mean the milk had a lot of fat in it that was coagulating on the cup, not made with skim milk.
So you think a skim milk latte might not stick to the inside of the cup as much?
That's right. That's
interesting. Right. That's a good thought. I ran some tests on this in preparation. You're not the only one who does research, okay, Mimi?
and you saw, a latte isn't food. It's a drink.
Well, that's true. Well, you drink too, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, all right. I think one issue you could run into with the latte foam, because you guys, you know this is an issue, right? Like the latte foam, it's an integral part of the latte drinking experience. And when half your foam ends up inside of the cup, that's disappointing. If you have a plastic lid on top of the cup that has just a small opening, that, I think, is liable to act as a foam filter. To
I
keep
can't
your filter.
Imagine drinking foam through the hole in the cup.
Well, right,
I would
I'm
think
saying,
you would take the cover off.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah,
right.
But are all lattes have foam? I don't order lattes. I get cappuccino.
Okay.
But that
has foam too, though, right?
Yeah, right.
So how do you deal with your foam?
Usually I don't get it in places that put it in paper cups.
Oh, all right. We're going to go to break, and as we do, let's listen to the wonderful music of Mamie Minch, who also performed at our live show in Brooklyn. Quick note, though, on the latte foam, I recommend a sort of a slurping maneuver. Stick your upper lip out over the foam and kind of vacuum it up as you drink with your mouth. You won't get all the foam, but you'll get most of it before it gets stuck in the sides of the cup. So, coming up, Mimi and I take more of your calls. She'll share her thoughts on carrot stick to dip ratio, and she'll tear into chefs who don't put salt on the table. Plus, we're going to get deep, you guys. At what point in a meal should you take the best bite? I'll ask Mimi. Stick around.
I know I'll make it to border radio one day, and that my guitar will ring out the Ohio. It'll go across the Mississippi down to Galveston Bay. I mean, they will hear me all over this land. Oh, I mean, all over this land. All over this land. All over this land. They will hear me all over this land.
Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. If you're enjoying listening to Mimi Sheridan, I hope you'll check out our other episode with her, also taped live on stage. She talks about growing up in a family obsessed with food, the perfect bagel and lox, and what her parents thought when she decided to become a restaurant critic.
My mother didn't like what I did because she thought it was mean to the restaurants. She used to say, a man opens a restaurant, he spends all this money, and it's successful, and one day in walks Big Mouth. My father was afraid someone would kill me.
That show came out in May. It's available wherever you got this episode that you're listening to right now. It's called Legendary Food Critic Mimi Sheridan Hasn't Been Hungry in 60 Years. Check it out. Now let's get back to the more recent Mimi, live on stage at the Bell House in Brooklyn, where it's time to take another one of your calls. Here's Mark. He's an ER doctor in Indiana, and he called in to share his thoughts on the ratio between the size of your carrot sticks and the amount of dip they have on them.
The vegetable-to-dip ratio, I think, needs to be consistent. The actual amount of dip that you get with the carrot stick is always going to be a variable. And it would be chaos if you had multiple sizes of carrots. What I found is that the tip third, once you cut that third off, you really only have to slice that carrot in half. The middle third, you slice it into quarters. And in the fat third, if you slice it in half and then slice each of those halves into three, so you're slicing it into sixths, you get roughly the same volume of carrot.
First of all, Mimi, can I just say, can you believe that I've turned this into a job? It's pretty good, right? I mean, I, you know.
Well, it's nice to know people's genuine concerns. Yeah. What's really worrying.
We're doing the big work
not,
here
not
on the Sportful.
Not the Republican debate tonight, but the volume of sauce to the carrots.
That's right. But really what Mark has hit on here, Mimi, is a fundamental issue on the Sporkful, which is the never-ending debate between bite consistency and bite variety. Mark is saying that he thinks that he wants the ratio of carrot stick to dip to be the same or as close to the same all the time. So he wants to cut his carrots so that every carrot stick is exactly the same size. How do you feel? Let's first just talk about carrot sticks and dip. Do you want bite variety or bite consistency?
Well, I don't like carrot sticks, but but I certainly don't want them to be all a uniform size because that indicates that they've been industrialized. And we don't have enough things that have an artisanal, handcrafted look. And
yeah, well, it has been a while since you've been to Brooklyn.
And I've been to Brooklyn.
Because, I mean, you can't kick a menu around here without hearing those words.
But, no, I think uneven carrot sticks would give me a little faith in the future.
Okay, all right. All right. Here's Laurel in Seattle. She's getting her PhD in computer science, and she's upset about the inconsistent way spicy foods are labeled in the store. She says one company's hot is another company's mild. Laurel is frustrated.
Why don't they have, you know, a couple days where everyone meets and tests their salsas, and then they get like a definite point system so that, you know, across all brands, it's uniform. I think it would help all companies out if, you know, customers could reliably, you know, go to any store and any brand and know exactly what spicy level they're getting.
I think you're advocating orthodoxy. Something I am against. I think everyone should have his or her own opinion of what is hot and what is spicy. We can't legislate spiciness.
Well, what I wanted to get into with you on this issue, and I agree with you, Mimi, spice is totally subjective. You know, so, yeah, one company's hot is another company's mild, but one person's hot is another person's
absolutely
mild.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, look, it'd be nice if we went by Scoville units, which is the actual scientific measurement for spice, and maybe you could have a number on the bottle so at least you would know what was spicy for you. I think that would be helpful, but the larger issue I wanted to get in, and you kind of hit on it there, is to what degree should foods be customizable? You have talked about the fact that these days restaurants don't put salt on the table anymore.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
I feel terrible about it because different people have different levels of wanting salt, and we don't all taste food the same way. And while I don't think you ought to have all kinds of seasonings on the table, salt is so fundamental that I really think it should be on the table. It began partly in the 70s when chefs began to become superstars, and they felt they made it perfectly and didn't want anybody to screw it up. And so they didn't put salt on. It was kind of a controlling thing. I've often thought of going around with a big box of diamond crystal kosher salt.
But so by that logic, how about... let's say that you're at, let's say you're ordering, Laurel, our caller, brought up salsa. Let's say you're ordering salsa and chips. What if the salsa were to be served to you mild with a little side dish of hot sauce or a mixture of hot peppers or whatever the hot components of the salsa would be in a separate side dish with a small spoon, and you could add as much or as little of that in as you wanted?
Well, so many Mexican-style places do have hot sauce on the table. Not the most elegant ones, but, I mean, I live near Benny's Burritos, and there are, like, three different kinds of hot sauce on the table all the time. Plus, they bring over jalapenos and vinegar. Not all chefs want to change things for people. The bigger their egos, the more likely they'll say, no, you can't have substitutions, or... if you want it rare, they say the chef likes it well done. I usually say let the chef eat it, is my feeling about that. But I would say in the more modern, innovative places where the chef is trying to show you something, then I think you either go to that kind of restaurant or you don't, because he's making some kind of point.
One more. Here's Brandon. He's a landscape architect in Michigan, and he's got actually a bit of a bone to pick with me.
So I really disagree with how much emphasis you put on the importance of the perfect bite. It doesn't take into account any, like, context or sequencing. Like, if you took a bite of a burrito and had, like, all beans, like, then my next bite, I would want it to probably have, like, a very little amount of beans, you know?
If I may just respond briefly at the top here, I think that Brandon has a little bit misconstrued my approach to the perfect bite. You know, yes, every bite is taken in context with the other bites. But I believe in the importance of the perfect bite as a platonic ideal. I think it's something we should all strive for. And I want to ask you, Mimi, because you've taken so many bites and so many thoughtful and considered bites. This is a question that I think is one of the deepest questions in the whole eater community. At what point in a meal do you want to take the best bite? Like, a plate arrives before you and you see, you can visualize the bites you could take. Maybe it's the biggest, best French fry or the perfect combination of turkey and stuffing or whatever it's going to be. You know where that bite is. Do you want to start off with it when you're hungriest? Do you end with it to end on a bang? Or do you eat it somewhere in the middle?
I think the second bite.
Second bite. Why?
Because I've tried the first, and that's exploratory. That gives me a sense of what's to come. And then I sort of think about it a little, and you can bring a sharper focus to the second bite. But I think the real test of something being properly made is if the last bite is also delicious and holds up and doesn't fall apart or get soggy.
All right, well.
I've never thought about it before this minute. You can believe it.
Well, it was a great answer anyway. And that's why she's a world-class eater. Ladies and gentlemen, her latest book is 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Big hand for the one and only, Mimi Sheridan.
Thank you.
So that's the Mimi Show, friends, the Mimi and Dan Show. I think we should take this show on the road. I see us going around the country, Mimi holding forth, just tearing into anyone who needs tearing into, and making everyone else love her, as she always does. Remember, if you want to hear more Mimi on The Sporkful, check out our episode from this past May. It's called Legendary Food Critic Mimi Sheridan Hasn't Been Hungry in 60 Years. Let's go out with a little more music from Mamie Minch. Not Mimi, Mamie. This is Razor Burn Blues, recorded live at Hobo Fest in upstate New York. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheSporkful. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/sporkful. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Our engineers at the Bell House were Bill Moss, Noriko Akabe, and Nate Kinsella. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Joe Franklin from London, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better. Now your mama don't mind if you swing it around. You can take it a carrot all the way downtown. And I mean dying by the hour. Got the razor burn blues, dying by the good Lord hour. I got those razor burn blues. It cost me $10 going down to see that mother for you. Holler now.